Morning, Glory, and Evening Grace, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Big day in the Middle East as Kobani is under siege. One-third of the town has already fallen to ISIS. Turkey is refusing to send ground troops in. An American delegation is in Istanbul pleading with the Erdogan government to get serious before a massacre occurs. And air assets are being deployed there. Repeated bombing runs have been made, but it's not making much of an impact. I have the perfect guest to ask about that in studio with me. Giora Rome is a retired major general in the Israeli Air Force. He is Israel's first fighter pilot ace, shooting down five MiGs in the course of the 1967 Six-Day War. He'd been brought to my studio by Stephen Pressfield, frequent visitor, always welcome, terrific author. And along came Joseph Timothy Cook, late guest host of the Hugh Hewitt Show. He had no longer guest hosting for us, but he's my retired partner. He is himself an A-4 pilot from the United States Navy days and thought he'd come along. He read Solitary. I read Solitary. And it's an amazing book. It's linked at HughHewitt.com. Interesting, before we go to the context of your captivity when you were shot down. We talked about it, Giora, in the first hour. You were not convinced in the early missions of the Yom Kippur War when you were flying the Skyhawk that it did much good to hit these ground emplacements. You wanted to go bomb the airfields. You wanted to hit the assets, and you did, and you felt good about it. Do you think these airstrikes that are happening in ISIS land are going to effectively degrade and destroy this terror army?
When you drop a bomb, no matter what kind of bomb, this is the last part of a chain of events, a chain of actions. The number one action is collecting intelligence and recognizing or identifying what is a target. And the toughest part, or the thing that you have to do, is to find out what are the targets that you want to destroy. To destroy today a target is a piece of cake. It's easy, because today's ammunition, ordnance, systems, aircraft are so advanced that this is not the problem. The problem is to be able to identify where are the targets, what are the targets, and how to connect the attacking aircraft with the target. And about that, I don't know what's going on there in the desert. It seems to me that in an open space where there is no ground-to-air missile defense, it's relatively simple, because today's ability to collect intelligence by different platforms is something that we never had any similar capabilities
before.
You know
that comes through in Solitary? You fight a war not to tell them anything that will hurt the Israeli Air Force. That's your mission from the moment you're captured. And you articulate it repeatedly throughout Solitary, the book, which is linked over at HughHewitt.com. You don't want to give them a shred of true information other than your name. They can't figure out who you are. They don't know that you're Israel's first ace. Did they ever get it? They never got it. They never. And, you know, today it would be about 1 minute, although everyone I know in the military says after someone goes missing, you never say anything. You don't spread words. You say nothing. Family, shut up. You don't do anything. Don't give any information away because of the speed of sound. But the Russians couldn't figure out who you were and could tell the Egyptians?
Well, you didn't have to be that smart those days after the Six-Day War. Because I shot down five aircraft, there were so many articles written about me. You could take the Aviation Week magazine and find about five-page article about me using my name. My photograph was in the papers. After I came back, we do not give any more photographs of pilots, but I was all over the papers, and I think the Egyptian could do a better job knowing who I were. They didn't. I was very happy about that, but it puts you in a very pressing position. What will happen the moment that Aziz, my interrogator, will enter the room and say, well, we know now who you are?
Let's talk about the cast of characters of your captivity. And I made a short cheat sheet for myself. There's Aziz. There's Absalom, the doctor, whose name is so much like King David's son. You remark upon that when you write. The guards Sami and Othman, the nurses Nadia and Isha, the Sudanese brute, who didn't have a name. Did he have a name?
No. I call him the Sudanese, not because he was a Sudanese, but he was very tall, very big. He had a dark complexion. And so I called him the Sudanese just to differentiate it from to differentiate him from others.
And his job was to beat you around the head.
He beat me very badly.
All right. And Anwar, the pilot, and he had Anwar, you know, later was killed.
He was killed in the 73 war. That was, for me, it was a big blow because I thought he was the most impressive person I met in Egypt.
Now tell people why.
Because he came one night to interrogate me, only for one night. He was extremely impressive in his appearance. His English was impeccable, and he was the first Egyptian pilot I saw which from such proximity. And we started to have a discussion of two pilots, unlike the discussion I had with Aziz, who was an intelligence officer but was not a pilot. And I had tremendous amount of respect to Anwar. I even allowed myself, if you remember from the book, to tell him that if he denies Jerusalem to be the capital of Israel, I'm not ready to answer anymore.
He got mad at you. You got mad at him. And then Saeed talked you guys off the cliff, right?
Yeah. That was a moment of I don't know if humor, but for
me, it was. Oh, I thought it was fascinating because as a civilian, I'm reading these two pilots. I've seen Cook around other pilots enough to know that they get very touchy about what they do and don't do. And you guys all of a sudden were a couple of peacocks. And yes. Saeed said, gentlemen, you're pilots, right? Is that what he said?
Gentlemen, you are pilots, you are not politicians, because the discussion was, is Jerusalem the capital of Israel, or is Jerusalem something that we took from the Arabs and we will have to give it back, or it will be taken by force? That's the way Anwar put it. And I said, Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, and if it is not, don't ask me any more questions. I don't care what you do to me, which is kind of a stupid approach by a prisoner that can be taken to solitary confinement in 5 minutes.
We're going to talk about solitary after the break, but there's also a segment in here where you unwittingly insult the Egyptians by sending a postcard saying, I'm sorry, some of my postcards are probably in the Egyptian Army Museum. That lands you in hot water because they're very, and I think this is important for the day we live in, where General Sisi's taken over the country and people have to understand the enormous pride the Egyptians have in their army, and you run into that when you're in confinement in their captivity. They're very touchy about that.
I didn't know that I was in. I didn't mean to insult them. That was supposed to be kind of a joke, but a very unsuccessful one. And they denied me food for a week. Not totally, but they gave me very little food. Now, if you have not gone through hunger, what is hunger? To be hungry for a week, you don't know what it is like. And for a week, I was hungry. I didn't have food. I was collecting every grain of rice that was given to me and fall in my bed. And after a week, they came and explained to me that I should never insult the Egyptian army ever.
You know, the other part of the book, it's graphic, and so if you've got little kids in the car, you might want to turn off the radio for a second. You can go read about it in solitary. Is that you're in a body cast, and you stink to high heavens, and you're dirty most of the time, and you communicate this. The smell must be awful in solitary confinement. Does it eventually burn through your nostrils like happens in jails, that you don't smell it? Or were you aware of just how degraded your condition was, the filth in which you were living?
No. Well, you are with yourself. You cannot run away from your smell or from the black crisp that covers your chest, which was the only exposed part of my body. But you get used to the smell and
the flies,
to the dirt.
You killed the flies and used them for checkers eventually. That was pretty interesting.
Yeah, but that was in the room, not in the solitary confinement that I killed the flies. But that was not the bad part, the smell and the dirt. This is part of the business.
When we come back from break, we're going to talk about Aziz and Saeed. Saeed, by the way, escorts you back to your prisoner exchange.
Yeah.
And he's got a very interesting goodbye, Captain, to
that,
you.
That was one of the most moving moments of my life. He escorted the the gurney where I was, with which I was taken to the boat, and he told the soldiers to stop. He turned to me, and I saw his lips trembling. And then he said in Arabic or in English, I'm not sure, "It was great honor to know your captain. May God save you and keep you for the rest of your life." And then he turned back. I couldn't answer. I was so moved by it. I couldn't answer, and he walked away.
It's a very moving part of Solitary. Solitary is a moving book. It's also Shackleton-like in its example of endurance. Go get it. Giora Rome's book is linked at HughHewitt.com. I'll be right back. 21 minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt. The good news is that the Dallas sheriff's official tested negative for Ebola. There really wasn't much chance of that happening. Meanwhile, the condition of the Spanish nurse with Ebola is worsening at this hour, according to the New York Times. Turkey, seeking a buffer against Washington, is refusing to send ground troops in. They seem to want American ground troops to go with them. We'll continue to follow all the headlines. If it breaks, we'll tell you about it. Listen more, learn more. But today I've got in studio with me special guest, Giora Rome, Major General Giora Rome, retired from the Israeli Air Force, was Israel's first fighter pilot ace. He's also the author of Solitary, The Crash, Recovery, and Resurrection of an Ace Fighter Pilot, that recounts both his career before and after his captivity and his 3.5 months captivity at the hands of the Egyptians in 1969 until his transfer Egyptian prisoners in December of 1969. He's brought to the studio today by our friend Stephen Pressfield, author of The Gates of Fire, Killing Rommel, most recently of The Lion's Gate, a book that never fails to make people cry when they read it, upon whom I push. It's done very well, hasn't it, Stephen?
Yeah, not too bad, Hugh.
And I think it's going to sell for a long time. And Joseph Timothy Cook, my retired law partner, is back in the studio with me because he's an A-4 pilot. He flew the same kind of plane that that Giora flew in the 73 war, which we'll talk about next hour. Let me take a call. Tammy J. in Portland. Hey, Tammy J., you're on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Morning, Glory, Hugh.
Evening, Grace.
Hey, thanks to you, Hugh, I first heard about Stephen, and subsequently I've become very good friends with his publicist, Callie, and had Steve on my show after reading The Lionsgate. And I have to say, if anybody out there has not read The Lionsgate, they must. I wanted to greet Steve. You're not only a great war historian, you're a great guy, and I'm honored to count you as a friend. And I want to tell Giora that I am simply in awe of your aviator exploits, which made you the first and only ace of the Six-Day War, but even more so, your courage and indefatigable spirit. I very much look forward to reading Solitary. And by the way, someday I'm going to talk somebody into giving me a ride in a fighter jet.
Now, that's harder than you think. I don't think they do that very easily. But thank you, Tammy J.
Thanks, Tammy.
When you went into this interrogation, Giora, and the first and some of the questions were off the wall. Now, it wasn't your interrogator who asked you who burned the Al-Aqsa Mosque. I mean, that was just the first question that you got in the youth and the anesthetic room, right?
Yes.
Explain why that's so weird.
That was out of Cairo. That was immediately after I went through the first aid treatment, and they put me in anesthesia. And when I opened my eyes, there was that Egyptian male nurse who asked me who burned the El Mosque, who tried to burn the El Mosque, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which happened a couple of months before when some insane Australian tourist tried to do it. And I said to myself, I came to Egypt under very unusual circumstances, and I'm not going to take upon myself the whole Middle East troubles right now. So I looked at him, and I said, not me. And that was it.
You know, there were some nights that you talk about, you do take on the whole world. You debate Saeed or some of your nurses or guards endlessly about politics, but there are other times when you don't do any of that, but always protecting this fragile fabric of lies that you built. And that's, would you explain to people how you went about your mission from the moment you realized, I'm a captive, I'm screwed, I've got to protect my Air Force and my friends. So you went about creating an elaborate cover story, like a spy almost.
I guess that's part of the personality that we had. Those who were trained or educated in the 50s and 60s, where we were trained to fulfill our mission. And my mission in captivity was not to disclose any information. That was my mission. Other have at that time other missions. They were flying, they were attacking, they were fighting. That was my mission, not to disclose any information. And I had a couple of days to prepare myself and to build some cover story, which I didn't know how long would it stand, if at all. But I started with it, and it carried out. I mean, it was okay. They came into me, to my story, and I saw that I could sell it, and I developed it, and I found ways how to remember it, which is one of the most difficult parts, is to remember what I said the previous night or two nights before.
It's very hard to maintain a complex lie. Anyone who's been a prosecutor knows that. Tim knows this. But you use, for example, the names of your apartment.
Yeah,
people.
Well, when they wanted very much, for instance, to know the names of all the pilots of the squadron. And when I was a child, we lived in an apartment house in Tel Aviv. At that time, neighbors were neighbors. They know each other. It's not like today that, you know, you go in the elevator, you don't know who is in the elevator. So I remember, until today, I remember all the 14 families' names of our apartment house. So these were the 14 names.
Even today?
Yeah, remember all the names of our neighbors, because we live within each other. This is the 50s, you know, when you had to go from one apartment to other to ask for an egg or to give a potato to somebody. So that was different kind of life. And I remembered the names, and these were the names of my co-pilots in the squadron.
And the people who used the front door were the lieutenants, and the people who used the back door were the captains.
Were captains, in order to make the differentiation.
And that held together. They couldn't ever figure out, because today I'm thinking to myself, with Facebook and Twitter and social search engines, you couldn't have lasted 1 minute. And I wonder how they've trained the pilots of today. Cook, when you were flying over Vietnam, did they train you the same way, don't give away any information?
Right. We had a code of conduct, a formal code of conduct, with, I think it was 5 or 6 steps, but it was basically the same thing, and we'd been through escape evasion and resistance training, and it had to do with that.
Were you trained to create a novel about yourself?
No, that specifically was not. That's why I found it fascinating, how you did that. And on your own, it was amazing to me. No, we didn't have specific training on that.
And see, impressive, it is kind of like writing a novel of your life with just enough in it.
That's what I was thinking reading, you know, Giora's story, how he created this elaborate story that had a plot and a backstory and, you know, twists and turns to it, characters, and kept it straight.
Now, I'm curious, when we had our debate and continue to have our debate over enhanced interrogation techniques, nothing like the Egyptians did to you, but including throwing people against the wall and extended periods of keeping you awake. I do not believe we use solitary to the extent they use solitary confinement with you. And I know that the Americans provide medical training, medical assistance at Gitmo of the highest quality. But do you follow those debates, or do you not follow them because of your prior captivity?
No, I follow. I don't. The whole book is about me not carrying any baggage about captivity. I guess that the whole story, the whole book tells the story of an individual who could get rid of a baggage that otherwise he could have slept the rest of his life, and that could have shaped his history, his life, and I got rid of it. So I can read it as any other person. All the discussion and written material about prisoners of war or interrogations.
Do you think the Egyptians could have done a different approach to you that would have gotten more information out of you? Aziz sounds like a fairly formidable interrogator.
The relationship between me and Aziz, who was the interrogator, were kind of intellectual battle. The point is the following. I'm a prisoner. They don't know what I really have in my mind about information. I don't anything about what they know as a background material. And then there is the discussion, and it's a very intellectual, if I may use this word, battle between the interrogator and the prisoner.
As you said, it's like a dogfight. We'll talk about that more when we come back. Solitary, Giora Rome's book. The General's book is linked over at HughHewitt.com. Go get it during the break. I'll be right back. 34 minutes after the hour, I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thanks for listening. In studio with me, Joseph Timothy Cook, my former law partner. Now he's retired from that. He's also an A4 pilot during the Vietnam War, and he came in because my guest, Stephen Pressfield, brought down his guest in the country, Giora Rome, who's in the country talking at UCLA. He also went to USC. I'm not sure you were able to communicate very well at USC. Did you go slow? Did you make it simple?
Just checking.
It was fine. It was a class of expert of PTSD, and they wanted to talk to me. And my recollection from when I was a student at UCLA that we beat them in football time after time, so I could make it.
I'm fascinated. I'm going to divert. Well, no, I'm not. I want to make sure I ask this question. What I learned in solitary most about your adversary is that they bring assumptions into the room. They had an assumption about how the Israeli Air Force fueled their planes that you couldn't quite figure out until you figured out what their assumption was, that you did it the same way they did it. And then you built that into your myth. So you probably screwed them up even more. Not only did you not give them anything, you misinformed them.
Look, I try not to save in a single word of truth. That was even some kind of a challenge to myself, even though I cannot pretend to tell you that I was challenging myself just for the competition. But I didn't want to say any word of truth. And when they were interrogating me about the refueling system, which was different in it, there is one thing that you learn by the time. We tend to look at our adversary as if they are a mirror image of ourselves. So you assume that if we do, let's say, morning briefing at 8 a.m., they probably make morning briefing at 8 a.m. But this is not true. The basic number one assumption should be, not only in aviation or aircraft, our adversaries have a different culture, a different way of doing the same thing. So you can tell whatever story you want. They will accept that you do things differently once you convince them that we are not a mirror image of each other. And it comes with a lot when you have discussions, not about military issues, but kind of civilian, in parentheses, topics. When I was in the hospital, the leading nurse came to talk to me. And I said to her, one day I will be back in Israel and you take good care of me and I would like to be your host in Israel. And she said, why do you say it? You know that by the moment I come out of the plane in Ben Gurion, at that time it was called Lod, you will stab me with your knives and you will kill me. And I was lying in bed and I said, Jesus, she is chief nurse. She's an intelligent woman. And she believes that when she comes to Israel, we will kill her. And you find out what is the gap between what country A thinks about country B and vice versa. And this is true all the way.
I also figured out, and Stephen, you wrote about this a bit in The Lion's Gate, the pride injury to the Arab world by the defeat in 67 was so pronounced. You couldn't even beat him at backgammon. Two games in a row without injuring their pride.
Yes, we played when the Red Cross came to, when I was taken from the prison to the hospital to meet the Red Cross person. In the second time, they put me in a nice room and I had two guards and they played backgammon. And I knew to play backgammon, I'm not a master. So we started to play and it so happened that I won the first two games. And the atmosphere in the room became very tense, and the temperature went down like in 15 degrees because I was winning a backgammon on my chief guard. So I made sure that in the next three games I will lose, so I will not hurt the Egyptian pride.
Well, the Egyptian pride, Stephen, the Air Force attack, as you said, the war was over in a minute, or it was actually over in the moment they had surprise in the air. That was their culture working against them. They couldn't imagine the radio silence, right?
That was the certainly the thing that Moshe Dayan said, and I think everybody else kind of went along with, agreed with that, that the Egyptians in the Six-Day War needed to put out sort of cover stories about their own victories. And I hate to compare it to body count in Vietnam, but, it kind of goes up the chain from the junior officers who are terrified to make a to report reverses or setbacks or something to their superior officers. So who knows what the superior officers get? They might even believe it. Like in the Six-Day War, there were reports that the Egyptians believed that American planes were attacking off carriers from the Sixth Fleet.
And there that mythology was in your imprisonment about the American. We'll come back and talk about it. The American pilot myth within the Egyptian Air Force was pervasive. The book is Solitary. It's an eye-opener. It's linked at HughHewitt.com. I'll be right back with G.R. Rome, Stephen Pressfield, Joseph Timothy Cook. Stay tuned. 44 minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt. G.R. Rome is in studio with me. Major General Rome was the first ace of the Israeli Air Force, shooting down five MiGs in 1967. He himself was shot down in a dogfight in 1969, spent 3.5 months in captivity, much of it brutal, a lot of it in solitary. We've been talking about the captivity period this hour. In studio with him, Stephen Pressfield, the author of The Lionsgate, a magnificent book about the 1967 war, and Joseph Timothy Cook. And joining me on the phone from Minnesota is our friend Lilacs. Lilacs, have you had a chance to listen at all to this conversation about solitary?
Unfortunately not. I've been pacing around the house wondering exactly how we can bring massive cybernetic pain to telemarketers. But that's neither here nor there, and compared to the struggles that you're talking about is quite irrelevant.
Well, you've tuned in at exactly the time, because we're just about to talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. G.R. Rome is in the country lecturing, among other things, about PTSD. And the central message, and I'm going to have him say what his central message is and have you comment on it, James, is what?
Is the trauma is part of our life. To be a prisoner of war is just one form of trauma, even though it's a terrible form. But traumas can have many forms. And it seems as if once you are going through a trauma, you find out that all your life until that period was kind of automatic pilot. You know, you were born, Pampers, some milk, then you go to the kindergarten, elementary school, high school, maybe college, but it's automatic pilot. Only when you go through a trauma, you have to decide, are you going to take your life in your hands, or you are going to lean or to ask help from some external forces. My book, Solitary, says that there are people who can take their future and their life in their own hands. It takes a lot of internal power, but it pays.
Lilacs, what do you think of the PTSD discussion? Because there's a concern out there, and I've heard it announced by veterans especially, that everyone's beginning to think that all veterans have PTSD and all PTSD is debilitating.
Well, I don't think that. And I grew up in a time when just about everybody's dad had served. And while they kept it to themselves, more or less the actual emotional damage that we didn't see. I've been working on a website about these ads that people placed in magazines back in the 30s where they were looking for people, people who'd wandered off around the corner and never been seen again. Some of them are quite poignant, some of them are amusing. But there was one I discovered yesterday from somebody in 1934 who was looking for his brother, who served in the trenches in World War I, was gassed and came back amnesiac, wandered away in 1919, convinced the Red Cross was out to get him, and had never been seen from since. And in those days, you heard about that when you saw a little tiny ad in the back of a Western Stories magazine. It wasn't something that was brooded about, discussed openly. At least now, we may err a little bit too much on the side of thinking that all vets have it, but at least the stigma seems to be gone, and the understanding of what they went through seems to be seeping to the general public. And like I said, in my generation, everybody's dad went into the service. Nowadays, even though we have all of these military operations, the disconnect between the military and the civilian population is greater than ever. So, getting the awareness out there is good.
We're going to talk about those separate universes in hour three, but you bring up amnesia at a very important point in the course of your captivity, Giora. You asked someone what they did in the 67 war, and they respond, I wasn't alive at that time. It's jarring. They didn't mind. The whole country wants to forget 1967 in Egypt.
So since I was in a complete inferiority when I was a POW, and different people used to come to look at me and to visit me in civilian clothes, the only thing I could retaliate with was to ask, what have you done during the Six-Day War? And they gave me all kind of answers, wishy-washy answers. One of them looked at me in the eyes and said, I was not alive during those days. And I looked at him. It was very unexpected. And he said, I erased those 7 days from my life. I don't want to talk about it. He turned back and disappeared, which was surprising, but people take very badly. And I mean, when you go through
when
something
I read
like
that,
this,
I thought I'll offer it to Lilac since he writes about everything.
Well, it's a reminder that even though we may know the bare bones of history, when a war started, when it concluded, who was fighting, that actually how it works its way into the psyche of a people and a culture is something that it's hard for us to understand. And, you know, we can be perhaps forgiven for not knowing everything about every war and how it struck the psyche of various nations. But what he's describing there is something that would be familiar perhaps to somebody, you know, in Egypt, but to us makes us scratch our heads and realize anew exactly how this affected
people. Well, I think what I was going to say is a lot of people have done this with 9/11 as they approach the war that we're currently in. I mean, a lot of people have willed it away, and they're willing ISIS away, James. They don't want to deal with this. And the New York Times today has a lead story on how the Republicans are trying to run on fear right now. And I was stunned by it. It's not irrational to be afraid of Ebola and ISIS. It's not like we're making it up.
No, it isn't. And it reminds you again that very shortly after 9/11, there seemed to be a general consensus that the imagery from which the imagery of the event should not be shown anymore. We couldn't see the pictures of the falling people. That had to be shielded from us. That had to be protected from us. And actual, you know, shots of what happened seemed to vanish. Now, maybe because they wanted to preserve the event and not overplay it like a favorite record. But the effect of it seems to be, how many people actually remember in detail what happened that day? Or do they just have an image of a smoking tower and then nothing?
Giora, when 45,000 missiles fell on Israel during the summer, does it traumatize an entire country, or is it a shrug-off thing?
4,500,
excuse me.
No, that was amazing because of the defense system that Israel developed called the Iron Dome. The Israeli public, not only took the 50 days of conflict with the Hamas in a very quiet way, most of the public was ready to go to continue on and on until we reach some kind of a decisive result. And we learned to live with those flying rockets. But as I said, Israel was clever enough to develop systems to counter those rockets, so the damage was very limited.
James, you think? Go ahead.
Because we don't have flying rockets every day, we don't have the decisiveness to end the conflict. We have our press releases saying that 9 airstrikes were made on ISIS positions, and that might even make the headline, the evening news. There is no desire for seeing this to its end, and that may be a result of the fact that we haven't been hit since 9/11.
I think that's where I was going. Lilac's always a pleasure. Thanks for calling in. Lilacs.com, America. I'll be right back with Giora Rome, Stephen Pressfield, Joseph Timothy Cook. Don't go anywhere. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. 55 minutes after the hour, America. Solitary is the new book by Giora Rome, Major General Rome, Israel's first ace. Until he was himself shot down in 1969, then he became a very famous captive as well. Released in December of 1969, Solitary is the story both of his career, his captivity, and his recovery from that captivity. And during the break, Stephen Pressfield was telling me, when you lecture on this, you use the Life of Pi book and movie as an analogy. The boy is trapped in the boat with the tiger. How does that play out?
I asked myself when I read first time Life of Pi, what is this a Bengal tiger with whom he spends like 270 days on a boat? And the whole story is the way he gains control of the Bengal tiger. And I thought that the Bengal tiger, we all, each and every one of us, has a Bengal tiger that either we control it, most of us can control, and sometimes the Bengal tiger, our personal Bengal tiger, comes over us. And my Bengal tiger was my captivity. And the second part of my life after I came back to Israel was to gain control of my Bengal tiger, which was captivity. Because if you think about taking a Mirage and fly again to Egypt and cross the border to Egypt, cross the Suez Canal again, or to penetrate to Egypt, this is a big Bengal tiger that it can eat you very easily. And to gain control of it, this is what life is all about. And I think that the message is that we all have our own his or her Bengal tiger, and we should do what Pi did in that boat. We should gain control of it.
That is absolutely what I got out of this book. And further, that when you cross back over, It's not the first time. Your Geneva lawyer, your lawyer in Israel has advised you, you won't be a POW with the rights of a POW. I had never realized that until if you get shot down a second time, you violated the understanding of that I won't take up arms against the captor nation.
So, again, that was one of many considerations I had in order to decide, should I regain my life according to what I had when I was young, or I give up and take a different course.
And Modi and said it's up to you.
And yes, and I decided that when I was young, I decided I'm going to be a pilot, a jet pilot, a good pilot, and I'm going to be a commander in the Israeli Air Force, and I was not ready for anyone to take me away from my course. So in life, you have to take risks. I took risks, and I'm very glad that I were successful.
In hour three, we're going to talk about from the moment he returns to Israel. He's greeted by Moshe Dayan, the defense minister, or actually chief of staff at that time, Modi, the head of the Air Force, your mom, your dad, your two brothers, Miriam, your wife. They all turned out for this exchange. And from that moment forward, hour number three, Solitary is an amazing book. Go over to HughHewitt.com, click on the link. I also linked The Lion's Gate by Stephen Pressfield. If you haven't read that yet, you'll want to read that. You'll get some third-person perspectives on Giora Rome as well. Joseph Timothy Cook and Stephen will be back as well as Giora. Stay tuned, America. It's The Hugh Hewitt Show.